WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Monday, May 22nd, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoon. The fallout from last Thursday's FBI whistleblower testimonies continues, as our worst suspicions about the agency are confirmed in spades. Three former FBI agents told the House Select Subcommittee on the weaponization of government about the deep rot and abuse of power within the agency. Congressman Matt Gaetz prompted testimony showing that, contrary to FBI Director Christopher Wray's claims, FBI informants and undercover officers were on the ground at the U.S. Capitol on January 6. Testimony also supported many American suspicions about why videos of the event continue to be censored from the public. It is motivated in part to prevent the public from finding out that the FBI was involved.
Is it your belief that you were retaliated against because you shared an email that questioned the truthfulness of FBI Director Christopher Wray?
Yes, sir.
And you believed that he wasn't truthful based on testimony he'd given to the United States Senate, isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
And in that testimony to the Senate, you believed that Christopher Wray indicated that there were no confidential informants and no FBI assets that were present at the Capitol on January 6th that were part of the violent riot. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
Please play the video. We're now going to hear from George Hill, who worked at the Boston field office.
The SSA in Boston said they were going to a political rally, which is First Amendment protected activity. No, we're not uploading. We're not starting cases on these people. To which they said, well, we're going to call your SAC. And the SSA said, go right ahead. Because when you're pushing back, you know, you want to make sure that you have your six covered. So the SAC and the ASAC were intimately aware of these kinds of exchanges that were going on. And again, to his credit, Joe Bonavolante said, no, we're not opening up cases on people who went to a rally. And I forgot a key part. The SSA for CT2 said, happy to do it. Show us where they were inside the Capitol and we'll look into it. To which WFO said, we can't show you those videos unless you can tell us the exact time and place those individuals were inside the Capitol. To which the SSA responded back, and I was privy to these conversations firsthand, why can't you show us, why can't you just send us, give us access to the 11,000 hours of video that's available? Because there may be UC's undercover officers or CHS's confidential human sources on those videos whose identity we need to protect.
So, Mr. Allen, you got retaliated against for the very thing, for saying the very thing that the Washington field office was telling Boston, when the Boston field office was saying, we're not going to go and investigate people that just showed up at a rally without sufficient criminal predicate. The Washington field office told Boston, well, you know what? We can't give you the evidence because it might disclose the very CIs and UCs that you are concerned about.
Whistleblower Garrett O'Doyle also confirmed that the FBI's Washington field office constantly pressured him to launch investigations on alleged J6 participants, despite the lack of reasonable evidence.
But that doesn't surprise you, Mr. O'Boyle, does it?
No, sir.
And the reason it doesn't surprise you is that in a different part of the country, you saw that same pressure from the Washington field office. And did they ever try to get you to do something that was outside the normal order of law enforcement activity?
Yes, sir.
And what did the Washington field office try to get you to do that violated the law and regulations?
They tried to get me to serve a federal grand jury subpoena when there was no proper predicate to do so.
And the reason there was no predicate was because it was based on an anonymous tip, right?
That's correct.
And time and again, the Washington field office was trying to pressure you without corroboration to go start process on people. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir.
And so while I agree that January 6th was a violent day, a bad day, a day that nobody wants to relive, violence on January 6th doesn't justify weaponizing the government against people who were innocent and did nothing wrong. Thank you for blowing the whistle on that.
Congressman Thomas Massie aired additional testimony from retired intelligence analyst George Hill. Hill described how Bank of America cooperated with the FBI in turning over customer data on debit and credit card use and gun purchases.
Big business is working with the government to weaponize against the American people. And, you know, the government says, well, this is okay because we're not violating the Constitution. The big business is doing this voluntarily, and we saw this with the social media companies. But I want to play a testimony from a whistleblower who's not here with us today. If you could cue that up about how we've seen, in this instance, one of the biggest corporations in America working with the FBI to violate civil liberties.
I believe it was either on January 7th or 8th, Bank of America, with no directive from the FBI, data mined its customer base. And data mined a date range of 5 to 7 years of any BOA customer who used a BOA product, and by BOA product, debit card. They compiled that list, and then on top of that list, they put anyone who had purchased a firearm during any date.
I find that testimony chilling. That was the retired FBI supervisory intelligence analyst, George Hill, who gave us that testimony. And what he said there is that Bank of America compiled a list of everybody who used a credit card or a debit card between January 5th and January 7th inside of Washington, D.C., and gave that to the FBI. But before they did, they looked at anybody who had ever purchased a firearm, according to their records, and elevated those people to the top of the list. And they didn't geofence it to Washington, D.C. You could have, as Mr. Hill testified, you could have bought a gun in 1999 in Iowa with a Bank of America card, and then you got heightened attention.
And Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene was on a tear last week doing what no one else in Congress has been willing to do. She was preparing a long overdue articles of impeachment for four members of the Biden administration, including the president himself. On Tuesday, May 16th, MTG announced articles of impeachment for FBI Director Christopher Wray and U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves. She accused Wray of encouraging, quote, Soviet-style tactics, end quote, against American citizens, and Graves of criminalizing political dissent while refusing to prosecute bona fide violent criminals. The following day, she announced articles of impeachment for Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas and Attorney General Merrick Garland. MTG pointed out that Mayorkas has aided and abetted the complete invasion of our country by deliberately flooding our nation with drugs, terrorists, and illegal aliens. She accused Garland of weaponizing the Department of Injustice and creating a two-tiered justice system. On Thursday, May 18th, Taylor Greene announced her intent to issue articles of impeachment for President Biden himself.
It is with the highest amount of solemnity that I announce my intention to introduce articles of impeachment today on the head of this America at Last executive branch that has been working since January 20th, 2021, to systematically destroy this country. The President of the United States, Joseph Robinette Biden. Joe Biden has deliberately compromised our national security by refusing to enforce immigration laws and secure our border, allowed approximately 6 million illegals from over 170 countries to invade our country, deprived Border Patrol of the necessary resources and policies sufficient to protect our country. And his administration has willfully refused to maintain operational control as required by the law.
Joining me to discuss today's stories is Executive Senior Editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Paul. Happy Monday.
Well, is it America last, systematically destroying this country, invading our country? Those are some strong accusations there from MTG.
Okay, here's the thing about Marjorie Taylor Greene. She says what everybody else is thinking, but doesn't have the guts to say it. And she does what everyone else, at least on the GOP side, is thinking about maybe someday possibly doing in half measures if we don't want to offend people too much, that sort of thing. She's sort of a one congresswoman, genuine opposition.
Yeah.
And as such, she has my unbridled respect.
Yeah. Well, she's kind of similar. Would you say she's a little similar to Boebert over there in the West and in Colorado? She's mouthy. She says the things that everyone is thinking, but I guess she doesn't push as much. But, I mean, yeah, it's great to see this. It's terrible that it's happening.
Well, it is overdue. And, of course, you know, much as I think, you know, Kevin McCarthy's is a significant improvement, at least so far, over the last GOP Speaker of the House, and certainly over Nancy Pelosi, I don't think he's going to act on any of these articles of impeachment anytime soon, but they're there now, waiting for political opportunity. So perhaps in 6 months, who knows? I don't know about impeaching President Biden at this point, because somebody advised Biden to pick the worst possible vice presidential running mate, so that as sort of a buffer, as an insurance policy against being impeached.
You think that's really what happened?
So,
like, pick this woman. She's terrible.
I don't think Biden's going to get impeached. I mean, he could have proven connections, to the mafia's Murder Inc. at Gemini Lounge, and they would not do anything about Biden. The others, though, Mayorkas in particular, should have been impeached a while back, and may yet. Some of them. I mean, some of this testimony was just, I mean, between the Durham report that was released earlier last week, and then the whistleblower testimony on Friday, which in truth didn't reveal a lot of things that we didn't already know as far as policy is concerned. But certainly, as far as, you know, the tearjerk heartstring factor, seeing those three, you know, by all appearances, you know, fine, all-American men, one of whom is a good old Wisconsin boy, by the way.
Yeah, Waukesha.
Yeah, sure. O'Doyle, I think, mm-hmm. was his name. You know, all three of these men, you kind of look at them and take their measure and say, okay, these are the guys that, you know, never wanted to do anything but serve their country. They were born to be, you know, military and that kind of thing. Obviously, very patriotic. And then to hear how they've been treated, I was not aware that whistleblowing is effectively off limits if you work for the FBI, that there's this exception carved out. So that was revelatory to me, seeing that. Mm-hmm. And then learning also the manner in which, for example, O'Doyle in particular is being systematically forbidden from finding any other source of income, any other work. So what they're doing is they're deliberately tormenting the man and his family. As was mentioned, we talked about this morning in our news discussion, they took his They seized his assets. What they did, in effect, was he was living somewhere out in the hinterlands, working as an FBI agent. And they said, hey, we'd like you to move to Quantico. We'd like to bring you back to home base. He and his family, you know, of course, the FBI paid to have them move. And literally the day after they arrived in Quantico, they said, oh, by the way, we're suspending you, taking your security clearance, and we're also seizing all of your belongings, which were at that time still in moving storage. And they held on to them for, I guess he got his belongings back after like 6 weeks or something like that. But more than a year later, he's still unable to earn any money, to have work. And that's just his story. The other two were equally galling.
Yeah.
And beyond them, there are a couple dozen other whistleblowers. One of whom, of course, was shown on video a couple times.
Mr. Hill?
Mr. Hill. But there are others beyond him who have come forth, and all of them are getting the same treatment.
Yeah.
And all of them are getting treated this way because they're saying, you know, we really shouldn't be going out and just opening investigations on pretty much any American who was in D.C. who wasn't a Democrat on January 6th.
Yeah, how dare they? Well, hopefully this emboldens all the other ones. I have no idea what it's like to be under the screw of the FBI, which is one of the most intimidating agencies out there. And hopefully that comes about. And how would they be able to keep O'Doyle from working? Like, how does that work? Is there like...
I don't know. But I mean, you know, this is a far cry from the benign FBI agents that used to be portrayed in, oh, I don't know, like that Disney film, That Darn Cat, from back in the early 60s. And, you know, the old slogan back then was, this is your FBI. They had a public relations campaign. Well, it's not your FBI anymore. And it's certainly not my FBI.
Yeah.
It clearly is a kept asset of the radical left.
It's really
a
Gestapo.
By the Democratic Party.
Sure, it's not hyperbole anymore, is it, to call it a Gestapo? Wow. Man, just scary stuff, because you don't know who could be next. You don't know, you know, we've seen this. They bust in people's houses who just showed up and whatnot. Scary stuff, man. Thanks, Steve. All right, stay tuned, folks, because we'll be right back to discuss the latest on the immigration border and Brittany Griner's new appreciation for our national anthem.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
Who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.
Welcome back. So it appears that our border crisis has plateaued at its current dismal state. Last Wednesday, the chief operating officer at U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported a 56% decrease in encounters between U.S. officials and migrants since Title 42 ended on May 11. The Biden administration replaced Title 42 with new rules that require those seeking asylum in the U.S. to first apply in other countries they've passed through. It also includes penalties for illegal entry, such as the potential for a 5-year ban on visiting the U.S. On Friday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security reported that in the week since the policy change, Border Patrol has averaged 4,000 encounters a day with migrants crossing between ports of entry, a significant decrease from the record 11,000 on May 9th and the 10,000 that border agents incurred on many days. President Biden seems satisfied with dubbing this a success.
The number of migrants approaching the southern border has dropped significantly since the end of Title 42.
Okay. How do you think things are going at the border, sir?
Much better than you all expected.
Border Patrol agents apprehended 4,200 migrants on Saturday, down from more than 10,000 a day before Title 42 expired last Thursday. The administration says numbers are down because it's increased processing for migrants seeking asylum legally, while also increasing deportations for those who don't.
We have to incentivize the use of the lawful pathways and disincentivize placing people's lives in the hands of smugglers, and we are doing that.
Monday, dozens of migrants not eligible to stay in the U.S. boarded an Immigration and Customs Enforcement flight from Alexandria, Louisiana, back to Honduras.
While Biden happily rides his bike and gloats about illegal immigration invasion, it's worth mentioning that during President Donald Trump's last year in office, Border Patrol encountered about 450,000 migrants, a fraction of what's happening now. The minute Biden was led into the White House, encounters skyrocketed. In fiscal year 2021, border agents caught 1.7 million migrants, more than triple of the previous year. The following year, that number increased to nearly 2.4 million. As for seriously trying to get the situation under control and implementing the same policy, this may be as good as it gets now, for now anyway. I want to let viewers and listeners know that our documentary on illegal immigration, Out of Control, the Immigration Invasion, is now available at thenewamerican.com in its entirety. We showed a good portion of it during our May 12th show, but you can watch it all on thenewamerican.com, and we highly, highly recommend it. And it only took a 10-month stint in Russian prison for American women's basketball star Brittany Griner to develop an appreciation and respect for her country. On Friday night, Griner stood for the national anthem before the Phoenix Mercury season opener. It was her first regular season WNBA game since the U.S. government secured her freedom in a prisoner exchange that gave Russia back arms dealer Viktor Bout, also known as the Merchant of Death. Here is Griner after the game.
Hearing the national anthem, it definitely hit different. It's like when we go for the Olympics, you know, you're sitting there, you're about to get gold put on your neck, and the flag's going up and the anthem's going. It just hits different.
This is a big turnaround from her comments in July 2020 when she told an Arizona newspaper, quote, "I honestly feel we should not play the national anthem during our season. I think we should take that much of a stand," end quote. Griner got caught up in all the anti-American claptrap triggered by the protests and riots after the death of George Floyd. Like so many people, she became a stooge for the forces working to discredit local police and sow chaos and division in this nation. Russia detained Greiner on February 17, 2022, at an airport for having vape cartridges containing hashish oil, which is illegal in the country. She was sentenced to 9 years in Russian prison after she was found guilty of drug charges. The U.S. government eventually worked out an exchange deal. Is there a lesson here? Should we send more of our ungrateful and brainwashed anti-American citizens to other countries so they can see how good they have it? What do you think, Steve? Is that, well, can we work that, something out?
Assuming that's not a rhetorical question, that would be a splendid idea.
Really?
In fact, we could have a prisoner of conscience exchange program with the People's Republic of China. And I'm sure the Chinese would be very accommodating to put several thousand of our worst woke offenders in their Laogais for a while. Or Turkey, you know, Turkish prison, I hear, is another good place. And obviously Russia, the Russian gulag is the old standby. Yes. I don't know how that can be done. I'm sure it'll violate all kinds of constitutional rights, but my goodness, an idea has a lot of appeal.
I've said this to my wife and various people I have conversations with who've never lived outside of this country, who've never gone through, you know, my parents, and you've lived outside of the country in totalitarian countries.
Yes, and I've been threatened with arrest for looking suspicious in
totalitarian
countries.
So, is that all it takes? Is it just context? Is that why people don't realize?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's not for everyone. I can understand why a lot of people, there's some people who don't even travel outside the United States, and that's fine. You know, that's a different lifestyle choice, I guess. But traveling abroad, particularly outside of the West, I mean, if you go to Europe or something like that, Western Europe anyway, or Australia, you know, you go there and you sort of vaguely realize, well, they don't have gun shooting ranges like we do, and there's some differences. You know, that people don't generally own houses as much, and they don't drive cars as frequently, use public transportation. And there are reasons for this, a lot of which have to do with the much more socialistic structuring of governments on the other side of the pond. But that said, you know, if you're in Italy or France or Germany, you pick up a newspaper, you see people are more or less expressing opinion, you know, there's pushback against government. And that we sort of assume the whole world kind of works the same way, and it doesn't.
Mm-mm.
Okay, I mean, you know, the old canard about East being East and West being West. You go and live in the East for a while, meaning, you know, East Asia or anything like that, outside of that penumbra of Western culture, and you'll find out real fast that people have an entire, you know, government is done differently. I had a friend once, I think it was from New Zealand, and I remember when I was living in Sri Lanka, I met these folks. They were members of my church. And so we hung out sometimes. And they were very adventuresome. They were in their 70s at the time. They traveled all through Asia and Africa and places like that. And the guy commented, he's kind of a crusty old fellow. And he commented one day, he says, you know, it's fun to travel around. But after a while, you visit all these countries, and they all kind of look the same. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, everywhere you go in these countries in Asia, their idea of how to deal with problems is they put a guy with a machine gun on every street corner, and they set up surveillance, and they bash some skulls in anytime someone steps out of line. They, you know, the same system. And so even though the landscape and the language may differ a little bit, the political system is essentially the same. It's top down, and you daresn't step out of line. And you have to experience that firsthand to really understand how good we have it. No, America's not perfect. And yes, there are injustices in our past and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But it doesn't compare
right.
to any of the alternatives.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for putting that so well. Well, that's all for our news segment today. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine. You can do so online at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783. Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. Also, we at The New American are excited to cover the World Council on Health's The Better Way Conference in Bath, UK. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko will be there reporting live, and she'll be hosting two panel discussions. Please visit betterwayconference.org and get your tickets. And stay tuned, because after this, we'll be showing Gary Benoit's interview with me, as I'll be discussing why the John Birch Society is still winning big. And afterward, we'll air Gary and Steve's latest installment on principles. We'll be right back.
imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect, but the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped from my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
This is Beyond the Cover with your host, Gary Benoit. And today we have with us Paul Dragoo, who is the host of the New American TV show, a daily program, as well as the communications director of the John Birch Society. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Gary. Happy to be here.
Well, we're so glad to have you. And of course, so often you are interviewing me, but in this case, it's just the opposite.
I don't know the last time I sat in this seat here, and I like it.
Which position do you like better?
Well, you know, it's easier to be here. I'm feeling pretty comfortable.
Okay, well, that's wonderful. And, of course, the reason you are here in this particular seat that you occupy is because of a feature article you wrote for the New American Magazine that appeared in the May 29 issue entitled, "The John Birch Society is Still Winning Big."
Yeah.
And, of course, that does seem a little contradictory to what the media is saying, does it not? Because the media characterizes us as almost a bygone organization, a show of its former self. And yet you are saying the John Birch Society is winning big. Well, of course, I know who's telling the truth, but why don't you elaborate?
Well, the funny thing about that is that it's actually the media who said that, and it's from a recent article. I believe it may be the Guardian. Mm-hmm. There's a book that just came out, another book that came out on the John Birch Society, mm-hmm. By a man named Mr. Dalek. And so the idea is that the media now is realizing that the John Birch Society, the ideas of the John Birch Society, the principles, all have all those years, all those generations of John Birch Society members working to educate and to mobilize members and to help spread education. Of course, the founder, Robert Welch, that was the founder of the JBS, and he had this saying, mm-hmm. education is our total strategy and truth is our only weapon. And so he believed a lot. He was an ardent believer that if we work to help spread this information and the news about what's really happening, it all came down to this, you know, this collaboration of for a one world government, which now people are seeing, oh, wow, this is really happening. He said, if we really worked hard to help people realize that's what's happening, there will be an awakening. And so that's what we're seeing right now. And the media just recently has come to the realization, at least a lot of the outlets, that that is in fact what's been happening. I mean, I have here, I have binders as the communications director for the JBS, which is my first hat, mm-hmm. Is, you know, I keep track of most of the media mentions of us. And recently, you know, we've had so many where they say things like, for instance, the John Birch Society never left. And there's several of them like that.
Right. Well, that's a great headline, the John Birch Society never left. And, of course, I do want to give you time, Paul, to go through a number of these examples.
Oh, we don't have to go through it.
but I'm sure I've seen many of the articles that you'll be referring to. And so often, even though they do give us credit for the fact that we do have people who are so knowledgeable today who are becoming part of the freedom fight, of course, they characterize that very differently. But they talk about the ideas, as you said a moment ago, that the John Birch Society was responsible for propagating these ideas. They really don't talk about the John Birch Society being a viable force on the American political landscape today.
Yeah.
And, of course, they want to pretend that we're not, even though we are.
Yeah. Well, I like to kind of reshape it and say that they focus on that. Now they kind of coming around to realize it, but you're right. In the sense that you've read almost all the same articles that I've read. We all read them and things like that. And there is the way that it is often phrased. It does seem like what they're saying is like, yeah, they had these ideas many decades ago. And now they seem, those seeds have sprouted and they've called, you know, they've given rise to MAGA and America First Movement and all other related movements. But they don't really say things like that they're here today. They don't really acknowledge as much of our impact today. The truth, and it's I'm positive that this will be something else, that another revelation that they'll have, maybe hopefully it doesn't take them a few extra decades, is that, first of all, the John Birch Society has never left. Second of all, the John Birch Society here. And third, and probably most importantly, the John Birch Society is still kicking butt. You know, our members from state to state, we have members in all 50 states of the United States, and we even have them outside of the United States, and we have fans and supporters out there too. But anyway, our members here in the United States are educating, are helping, passing out, or helping Americans understand the threat. They're also helping reawaken Americans to the principles and the values that built this nation, because we lean hard on that. We work so hard to help people understand that the answer to restoring this nation is getting back to the fundamental principles of the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and even the value principles that are based on Judeo-Christian foundations. So our members are working. They have various things that they're working on. Of course, they've been instrumental in making sure that we don't lose our local police. So that falls in line with our Support Your Local Police action campaign. We've had that for a long time. They're fighting on protecting and guarding the Constitution by preventing an Article 5 convention to amend the Constitution. And that's another way. They're fighting on the homeschooling front and in the private schooling front. The John Birch Society has an affiliate school, Freedom Project Academy. So on the one hand, we have a school where we can send where parents who have realized how insane the government schools have become, they're like, well, what do we do? Well, you have a couple options. We have a campaign called Save Our Children from Public Schools. You know, you could do private school or you can do homeschooling. We advocate for both. And so that's another front we're working on. We're also working on the election integrity front. We have members all over, again, helping to understand what election integrity reforms we need. And, you know, it comes down to some pretty basic steps. You know, we need to get rid of the machines. We need to go back to paper ballot where we can track those, and we need to vote on same day at the same at local precincts where we can watch the voting. And we have a speakers bureau with speakers who travel or who do webinars to help people understand furthermore what this looks like. What does it look like to implement election integrity in your state? What does it look like? Where can you go if you want to pull your children out of government schools, but you don't know where to start? You know, all of those. Why do we want to support local police, and how do you do that? We have several, I think about 10 or 14 major action campaigns, and our members are working on every one of them. You know, some have, it's not like they're working on all of them. How do I explain this? Well, not all our members are working at the same time. You know, some are focusing on this and that. But we have members everywhere, thousands of members, whatever, all over the place. And they've each chosen various campaigns to work on.
And of course, not only are our members working on those things, but they're making a difference in all those areas that you mentioned, Paul. But, you know, we should feel good in a sense about the fact that the media that has so, for many years, ignored us completely because they realize that when they attack us, people actually look at us and they find out that we're different from the characterization in the media, and we grow. that after all these years of the silence treatment, that in more recent years, the media is mentioning us. And they're mentioning us, again, in terms of what we did in the past. But with more time going by and with our organization, the John Birch Society, being so vibrant and growing, I wonder how long it's going to take, Paul, before they finally do acknowledge that, yes, we are making a difference today, not just based on what we did in the past, but what we're doing today.
Yeah. Well, I have no idea how long it'll be before they realize that again. I think part of the reason that we're seeing what we're seeing as far as the media's reflection and writing about us is it's kind of like the same thing, you know, when they write about other things that they don't like, and that being that they're kind of warning and they're raising the alarm bells and they're kind of freaking out, you know, the way they talk about conspiracy theorists and anti-vaxxers and things like that. I think it falls in line with all of that. Is they're like, here's who you can think for, you know, these crazy conspiracy theories and why there's this fracture in the GOP. And of course, we've gotten credit for that, and we're not going to deny that credit, because there is a huge, huge component of Birchers, again, legacies, generation, a rich legacy of generations of Birchers who have worked hard to bring that about, to bring the knowledge about, make it public knowledge and reaching a tipping point of majority knowledge that there is this conspiracy.
I do believe, Paul, that if it were not for the John Birch Society, if it were not for this great organization that Robert Welch created, that we would not have the freedoms that we still have today. And yes, those freedoms are under attack, but can you imagine a world without the John Birch Society? But Paul, let's take a look at some of these examples that you have from the major media.
Yeah, well, I this was actually spurred by, I think the first, some time ago, a couple weeks ago or months ago, there was The Atlantic, they kind of came out and they attacked us. And it was funny because the piece that came out after, came out then, was one day after a report on fluoridation, a draft report was released. So one of the things that they had said about us was that we were kooks because we had alleged that fluoridation was dangerous. So that's, I found that kind of interesting because, again, just the day before, there was a draft of it from the National Toxicology Program. They had a draft. They worked 6 years on it. And what they had found was that, in fact, there was a link between prenatal and childhood fluoride exposure and reduced IQ. And we had written in our predecessors to the New American, the American Opinion, and I'm not sure if we did in Review of the News, several articles, which I include sections of in the, today's article, about why fluoridation is not, you know, it should be suspect. And so I kind of started with that. I kind of started it off. And so they're like, well, there's a conspiracy theory that supposedly was kooky that we're finding out, and right, that we never really let go of anyway.
Right.
It was true.
Yep. And then I kind of... Conspiracy fact, conspiracy theory.
It is a conspiracy fact. And that's how it... I mean, that's kind of a good illustration of how it goes for pretty much anything JBS. We say something, and the media will jump on us, and they'll say, "Oh, those conspiracy theorists, or those kooky, wacky birchers and whatnot." And then, you know, then we find out, wow, it's true. You know, it's
right. And of course, Robert Welch also referred to the whole push for fluoride as being communist or communistic, and a lot of people mock that, and in fact, they do so up to today, but. But when you think about it, of course it was. I mean, this whole idea of putting something into the water supply, regardless of how effective fluoridation may have been or may not have been.
If it's good or bad, yeah.
But the whole idea of just putting it into the water supply,
yeah,
having to do with not treating the water, not making the water safer, but having to do with treating people, that really is communistic. That is forced medication.
Yeah.
So look at what we have today, where people argue today, well, we're going to take this experimental vaccine and we are going to inject it into your body, and you're not going to have any choice.
Yeah.
If you're in the military, you're forced to get it. If you're working for an employer, private enterprise was put under tremendous pressure to arm twist their employers to get these vaccines. That's communistic as well. But that whole principle of mass medication, where you don't have freedom of choice in medical therapy, you can trace that right back to fluoridation. So Robert Welch and the John Birch Society really called it correctly.
Yeah, yeah, that was a precursor to the COVID campaign. And of course, the New American and JBS were among the first when COVID tyranny popped up as well. We have so much documentation, and you know, you guys did such a good job here, the New American, with the Freedom is the Cure campaign. Right away, we saw right away that where this was going. Not only that, but we also saw right away why this was wrong, the lockdown. At the time, it was the lockdowns and all the various restrictions and things like that. And we had pointed out over and over, it's like, this is why it's going to be bad. We said suicide was gonna increase, substance abuse, depression, all those things, which, of course, then we learned, unfortunately, became true. We also predicted, I believe, Dennis Baird, the publisher of the New American, I believe it was in June, maybe a half year to 4 or 5 months before, he warned that there would be, when they came out with the vaccines, they would try to coerce you into having them into mandating them. So there is a culture. There has always, from the beginning, the John Birch Society and obviously our affiliate magazine and our schools has always had this culture, and we've been blessed to have it, where we see through the globalist lens, and we see the traps around the corner and things like that. And it's not necessarily because we're prophetic or anything like that. I think it's simply because God's given us the wisdom and the wherewithal to see that this is where it's going to lead, and we're very familiar with the principles. And a lot of times we just lean on that. I think you actually know better, more about this than me, Gary. You've been a Bircher for a long time. You've edited so many of this. So why don't you finish us off on that?
Well, I know that more and more the things that we have said over the years that the media has dismissed is conspiracy theory. Those things have turned out to be conspiracy fact. In fact, I can think of one recent example this week, can't you? Or
which one?
The Durham report.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. Which one are you? Because yeah. There's been so many.
The Durham report, because
they said
that showed that there really was no Russian hoax. Not only that, but that the FBI, not having any evidence, pursued that anyway for political reasons to try to stop Trump.
Yeah.
Well, there is another conspiracy theory that became a conspiracy fact.
That was such a conspiracy, wasn't it? I mean, yes. It really was. And then we also covered the conspiracy, the collaboration between big tech and government to silence too. We're seeing, yeah. I mean, they're everywhere, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, thank you, Paul. And we should sign off, shouldn't we, by recommending that people look into the John Birch Society, and we encourage all freedom-loving Americans to join if you're not already a member. And to find out more and to join, go to jbs.org.
Yeah, jbs.org. You can sign up there. You can learn more about us. You can apply for membership, watch videos, sign up for legislative alerts, a whole bunch of stuff. But that is jbs.org. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10OFFSUB. Again, that's 10OFFSUB for more than 50% off.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Does your family have an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand? With all that's going on in the world today, why would you not? We have attacks on our power grid, our banking system. We have the actual threat of a banking collapse. Of course, people are talking World War III, chemical spills, and so much more. I've had an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand for my family since 2013. And then we began offering it to our audience as a service to them. But it's also a big part of our general operating budget. So thank you for purchasing it from us. We can help you and you can help us. We all win. So let me tell you about it. You can order it right now and get free freight. We're offering free freight. For some of you, that's going to save you hundreds of dollars because you're ordering a one-year supply and a two-year supply. And we're offering free freight. So you can order it at WVWTVstore.com. That's WVWTVstore.com. You can also call and talk to someone over the phone, and they'll answer all your questions and take your order, track it all the way to your front door. That number is 901-468-9357. We have the gluten-free kit right here available, and it comes in the individual pouches of the individual entrees. Easy to make, easy instructions to follow. We have a 3-month, 6-month, 1-year, 2-year mega protein kit with real meat and the ultimate breakfast program as well. All the details, WVWTVstore.com. It has a 25-year shelf life, as I said, but we offer more than just freeze-dried food. We offer also emergency supplies. We've thought about the things you're going to need should the power go out or there's a crisis, like a little stove. All you need is a little bit of kindling, start a fire, use that stove, and then the custom pot goes on top to boil the water. We also have the water purifiers, as well as hand crank and solar radios and flashlights. Everything's available for you to check out now at WVWTVstore.com or using the number on our screen. Thank you.
To cap off today's program, we'll go to Steve Bonta and Gary Benoit for another episode of Principles.
With me today is the executive senior editor for the New American Magazine, Steve Bonta. And Steve, we're here, of course, to discuss another principle. And today's principle has to do with the fact that the powers that government possess must come from the rights or the powers that the people have to begin with.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And I mean, we already mentioned this in our last discussion of limited government. Overall, I mean, the idea that government comes in the first instance from some sort of popular consent, or if you prefer social contract, I don't really like that term, mm-hmm. but it's a familiar one. Well, then that presupposes that whatever government does, whatever powers government has, they've been delegated in some sense from the people who originally consented to form it, okay? And so that means that government cannot justly exercise powers that haven't been delegated to it. Now, you know, we do use this term, one nation under God, in the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, there's this idea. And so, I mean, if government arose purely by some kind of a social compact or agreement and has its rights delegated from the people only, so what role, if any, does God play in it? And here's the role, okay? Suppose that you have a group of people who don't possess the fullness of correct moral standards, for example. Roman Republic would be a good example. The Roman Republic was, for all of its considerable virtues, was a pre-Christian pagan republic. And among its many laws, there were a number that we would find absolutely heinous. For example, it was required to put deformed children to death.
Well,
under the Roman, the original right. tables of Roman law, which was sort of a consensual thing. I mean, you know, if you want to find an example in history of a government that, at least according to tradition, arose in this kind of Lockean way of a small group of people getting together and setting up a new government. I mean, the early history, somewhat legendary history of Rome approximates those conditions. Okay, but those people didn't necessarily, so in large measure, the laws they framed were just. And right. but there were some things there that weren't necessarily good.
But I want to go back to what you said about deformed babies, though. Mm-hmm. Because aren't we doing the same thing today via abortion?
Sure, exactly. And you know, and obviously in many states, as we're seeing now with after Roe v. Wade going away, many states, apparently a majority of the citizens, do support abortion on demand. This is a very unfortunate legacy.
Just, and for healthy babies.
Well, it's an unfortunate legacy of 50 years of propaganda and Roe v. Wade that has essentially turned a lot of people. So we don't assume, I mean, there's this old expression, and it comes from the French democratic tradition, you know, vox populi, vox Dei, which means the voice of the people is the voice of God. And that is not true. Okay, it is not necessarily the norm that the people or a majority of the people believe in or want or stand for something that's counter to God's laws, but it does happen.
But so obviously the higher the morality of the people, the closer views of the people would be to the ideal.
But, and this
and
is,
of course, that's based on religious convictions, too.
Sure. Well, and this is why Montesquieu, back when he wrote his wonderful, L'Esprit de Loi, the Spirit of the Law, which was a real source of inspiration for the founder. It was apparently the book where the idea of, you know, the three cardinal types of government power that we all learned about in grade school, you know, the executive, legislative, and judicial power, that comes from Montesquieu. A number of other things as well, the need to divide power, to have checks and balances. Mm-hmm. Less known is his typology of governments that he provided, where he would list a government, and then he would say, every type of government has a cardinal social attribute necessary to sustain it. So with tyranny, which he listed as a type of government, that was fear, right? You can't have a successful tyranny unless people are cowed into obedience. A monarchy, he said, requires honor as its bedrock, condition. But a republic requires virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so a non-virtuous people are not capable of sustaining a republic.
How would you define the difference between honor and virtue?
Well, I think by honor he meant honor in the sense of respecting the way things are, serving honorably your liege, that type of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So certainly all feudal systems are predicated upon honor. And to a lesser extent, monarchies as a whole, there's this notion that in some states, you know, national honor and prestige is all bound up in the symbolism of the crown. I think that's what he meant.
Right.
But by virtue, clearly he means popular virtue. Virtue, comes from a Latin word, which at root means strength or something like that. But you know, what we would understand by virtue is your conduct squaring with God's standards of morality and perfection as far as possible. And so that obviously can be an individual characteristic, but it can also be a social characteristic. And many of the historians of ancient Rome, meaning the people who lived in those days, remarked over and over again, we lost the Republic when the people lost virtue. You know, as pagan or not, under the Roman Republic, the men were faithful to their wives. Mm-hmm. The family unit was preserved. And all these other things. I mean, the Romans had something, similar to what we would call, the traditional family unit. And it was absolutely sacrosanct to them. Valor and willingness to sacrifice for the greater good, all these things. Which, by the way, is a virtue as long as it's not being coerced. The first thing you see in tyrannical governments, they always demand more and more sacrifice. Because the more tyrannical they are, the more reluctant people are to sacrifice. But in a truly virtuous, popular form of government, a republic, people will be willing to do that, will be willing to give their lives, perhaps, if necessary. So this is all bound up in that, right? So we're making this assumption that when the people get together and frame a government, that they're going to delegate to that government powers that are just,
mm-hmm.
right? Because obviously they can get together and say, you know what? We're a bunch of thieves. We're going to create a government that's based on the principle of thievery as well, which is unfortunately, this is what socialism is. And to the extent that America has embraced it, we see institutionalized thievery, although we call it something else, wealth redistribution, but that's what it is. It's forcibly taking from one group and giving to another. So it's in effect enshrining this immoral principle of taking forcibly from one person to another, clearly in violation of the eternal order of things, of God's commandments, right? So it is possible for a government by consent to not necessarily be fully virtuous. So our objective really is twofold. We want to have a government that the people consent to, but we also want the laws that are framed to be just. So those are two interrelated things, but they're not the same.
You also want to limit
the power of the majority too.
Well, because, certainly, and that's right. one of the yeah,
there's something called the tyranny of the majority, and a majority of people could violate individual rights just as easily as a monarch could, or a tyrant.
This is the whole problem with the idea of consent, is that people who are opposed to it, you know, including some people on the right who will say, well, this is just nonsense because when I was born, I didn't consent to be born under this, you know, republic, this country where we no longer honor our own laws and so forth. And there's truth to that. Right. You know, I mean, the consent that was involved really was the original consent of the founding generation. And even there, of course, it wasn't universal. The anti-federalists opposed the Constitution. And, you know, perhaps with some
justification. Right. Of course, they opposed the Constitution from the point of view they were concerned that it was creating a government that would be too strong.
Right. So, I mean, so you always have this issue, you know, that as soon as you get beyond the level of a very small family unit or sodality, you know, that you're never going to have 100% consent. You know, so the question is, those who dissent, are they doing so because they're essentially lawless, they want to be criminals, or because in the case of the anti-federalists, they have legitimate concerns and you know, disagreements with the system? So it's, you know, in practice, of course, it doesn't become quite as black and white.
Right.
You know, there are gray areas, and so I think, you know, this, you can't cognize any of these issues fully by looking at them in the same way that you might look at a mathematical equation or something like that and say, well, here's a law, here's how it's applied, here's the principle. You know, I mean,
right.
The principles exist.
Are very clear.
They do.
But the application of the
application is
murky.
Precisely, because of human nature, because of the complexities inherent in any type of humans, even in an individual, let alone a congeries of individuals that we call a society. So, you know, I think that the course of wisdom is to try, as Locke and many others did, to discern the principle, to understand that, you know, there are always these gray areas.
Right.
And also to recognize that people who steadfastly ridicule Locke on that basis, these are people who in their hearts completely disagree with the idea that government should be consensual at all or whatever. So you mentioned majority rule. I think we'll discuss that more in a later principle.
Sure.
But that's obviously the part and parcel. Right.
But the point being, if you're talking about the people can certainly go in a very bad direction.
Sure. And I mean, as we explore the details and workings of government, we'll see that there are a whole bunch of other, you know, subsidiary principles that allow this consensual-ish government that we call a republic to actually function.
Right, and also the importance of morality, because the solution is not to say, well, gee, people are immoral, therefore they can't be entrusted to have, you know, self-government. That's not the solution at all. The solution is for the people to become informed, both in terms of the principles of sound government as well as morality. Well, thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Kerry.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And don't forget to visit thebetterwayconference.org and get your tickets to this wonderful event, which is another reminder that freedom lovers around the world are coming together and demanding a better way. We will see you tomorrow with more news.
All right, everybody. Dr. Andy Woods here. This is Pastor's Point of View number 231. I'm here with a very special friend and guest, the Honorable Rick Miller. And this particular video is going to be released on the eve of a very important midterm election that's right around the corner. One of the things that, you know, a mutual passion we share is why God's people, you know, are not more involved in the political process, because a lot of the insanity that we see happening in our culture, we think we can actually put the brakes on some of it if we go out and vote intelligently and biblically on November the 8th. Early voting in Texas, do you have the dates on those?
Early voting starts Monday, this coming Monday.
Okay, that would be the 24th?
Yes.
And it goes through the 4th.
Yes.
And then the election is November 8th.
Correct. Tuesday the 8th.
So let me this is a man next to me that has a tremendous background and resume, and this is why we wanted to use him as a reservoir to draw from, you know, during this critical time in our nation's history. So let me just read his bio real quick. Rick Miller attended the United States Naval Academy. I don't know if you know this, but my grandfather went there. There's actually on the rowing team, there, on one of the boats there is named after him at the
is that right?
Naval Academy. And that. Then I had an uncle that went there as well.
Oh, my gosh.
And the other what uncle went to the Air Force Academy. So we have a lot in common here. He also attended the Dwight D. Eisenhower School for National Security and Resource Strategy, where he earned his Bachelor of Science degree. Rick Miller was a member of a baseball team in Mexico. Wow.
Nice.
For which he later worked as a United States Naval Aviator, in which Miller served in top arrangements. He served as a fellow for the Strategic Studies Group, the Chief of Naval Operations, if I have that right.
Okay.
Rick Miller had earned medals such as the Meritorious Service Medal, Legion of Merit, and Defense Superior Service Medal. Mm-hmm. He also earned the Naval Commendation Medal. After being discharged, Miller had established, and you're going to have to help me with this corporation, the
Trevanion Group.
How do you say that?
Trevanion
Group business, for which he was the chairperson of the TEC International and was a member of the chairperson of other establishments. In 2013, Miller won election for the 26th District of the Texas House of Representatives. He succeeded politician Charles Howard. Miller and his wife live in Sugar Land. He currently is involved in 3 not-for-profits supporting foster children, veterans, and then the preservation of historic sites.
Yes.
So you always have been and continue to be a pretty busy guy.
Yes, I think I should be busy. The older I get, the busier I want to be. So.
Well, it's interesting because in an email, which kind of led to this program, you know, you were talking about, just to me privately, about the upcoming election and how we need to get Christians engaged. And you were talking about how you, when you were in the Texas House, saw that as sort of a divine calling. And you tried to reflect Christian values when you were in that role. So am I representing that right? And how did you come to that way of thinking?
Well, you're absolutely right. And I have to go back and give credit to my first wife, Babs. She and I, when we moved to Texas in around 2000, we started to get settled in, and then we met the right people who were encouraging us to get involved in the political scene here in Fort Bend County. And so after that, I went to an evening with a pastor, Rick Scarborough. I don't know whether you've heard of him.
I do know him, yeah, or know of him.
Know of him. And so I'm sitting listening to him talk about why he was doing what he was doing, especially in the education of our children, because he stepped out of his pastorship to take on this mission of educating people about what's happening in our school systems. And so I'm sitting there listening to him talk, and I say, you know what? Babs, he's talking directly to me.
Mm.
That I need to step up and I need to get involved. And so I did and ran for my first political office of a precinct chair, which is the basement of all offices. And then shortly thereafter became the chairman of the party here in Fort Bend County. Mm-hmm. And then the State House. So that's what happened to me.
Yeah, so it's just one baby step after
one
another.
Baby step.
The Lord opening different venues.
Right.
Now, we were talking a little bit off air how one of your mentors is a gentleman by the name of Norm Mason, and you have gave me this book a few years ago.
I did.
But this is a critical book to your understanding. The title of it is The Political Imperative, The Assignment from God, The Biblical Role of Christians in Public Policy, Civil Government, and the Political Process. Tell me about Norm Mason and the contents of this book.
Well, Norm is a fantastic individual, a strong Christian man, always has been, and he and his wife were really involved in all of the political activities at the time, the right political activities from a Christian perspective. And so Norm wrote this book, I believe, in 2011, right when I was standing up to run a campaign for the Texas House. And so Norm was a mentor. And then if you read this book, it's a short little book, but it tells us the imperative is for us as Christians to get involved in the political process in one way or another, mm-hmm. either as participating in the process or encouraging others to do that. Mm-hmm. And so it's a short read, but it's all biblically based. Mm-hmm. And God created these three entities, the government, the family, and the church. And so it meant a lot to me at the time. It encouraged me to stick with it and to work hard. And I just put my faith in the Lord. I said, Lord, if you want me to do this, then I will get elected. Mm-hmm. And I got elected. So.
And people can get this, I would assume, wherever books are sold, internet.
They might be able to. Again, it goes back. It's over 10 years old, 11 years old. So I'm hoping that it's still available to get. And I can talk to Norm and see if he still has these books. But he gave me a bunch of them.
Okay. So if you need a copy, you can contact us even here at Sugarland Bible Church.
We'll try to. Yeah,
we can connect it and get this
done.
But
I would strongly encourage people. Christians to read this.
Because the contents of this book really represent what we want to talk about here. We're on the eve of a pivotal midterm election. Most Christians are sort of, we'll talk about this as we progress, they have a tendency to look at politics as the secular world, and let's just focus on the gospel, the church, evangelism, all important subjects.
Right.
But people have a tendency to bifurcate these in their minds spiritually, and this is the type of thing that this book critiques, right?
It does.
Okay.
It absolutely does.
So we're going to get into that. So, you know, what I have, just for purposes of easy memorization, are four S's. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As we, you know, talk about the Christian involvement in public policy. Okay. So let's start with stewardship. Here's our list of four, but we have the concept of stewardship in the Bible. I'm thinking of 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 2, where Paul the Apostle says, in the case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. I'm also thinking of Matthew chapter 25. Verses 14 through 30, which is really the parable of the various stewards. Mm-hmm. And you know that parable well. I'll just read the opening line here. It says, for it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted them with various possessions. To one, he gave 5 talents, which is a numerical denomination at the time this was written. To another 2, to another 1, each according to his ability, and he went on a long journey. And so the point of it is the Lord returns after a season, and he wants to know, what did you do with what I gave you?
That's right.
And so we have in the Bible a concept of stewardship. A steward is not an owner, but a manager.
That's right.
And we manage things for God, and the day in history will come where he's going to say, hey, what did you do with what I entrusted to you? And I think the three things that we're given to be stewards of are A, our time, mm-hmm. B, our talent or our abilities,
right.
and C, our treasure. Mm-hmm. The three T's, as I call them. But here's an element of stewardship I never hear spoken of in Christianity. How about your own government?
That's true. Absolutely right. And of course, you know, we're not necessarily seeing that stewardship today in our government. I go back to my initial involvement in the Texas House. And one of the things we talked about earlier was the Texas legislature was set up with a House and a Senate mirroring what was going on in Washington. Now, I haven't researched this, but for information, there are 150 members in the Texas House, and there are also 150 Psalms.
In the Book of Psalms.
In the Book of Psalms. And there are 31 members in the Texas Senate. Well, guess how many Proverbs there are?
31
Proverbs. 31. So when I was going out and I spent a lot of time out in the public talking about that, I would always bring up to you, hey, do you know what the number 150 means? And I would always relate that to, well, oh, by the way, this is the way the legislature was set up. 150 members after the Psalms and 31 after the Senate. So, but you're right about the stewardship, and God has given us so much in this country that we need to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. It's our responsibility to do that. And so I looked at that from my role in the legislature. Matter of fact, I set up a little matrix of decision-making whenever I would consider a bill. And one of the items on there, if not the first one, was, is this a biblical worldview thing, bill that I can vote for? And then there were other things about, you know, anyway, did it meet my other criteria? And so I think it's so important for us to be good stewards of what God has given us. And he expects us to do that, mm-hmm. I think. Would you agree?
Well, you know, the thing is, we have a privilege that most people in human history could only dream of, where we have the ability as Christians, I mean, they don't have this in Saudi Arabia, I guarantee you, the ability to influence the direction of our government through voting, through going deeper than that, as you've done with your career, becoming involved in the public policy process, and of the T's, time, talent, and treasure, I have to add stewardship over the American government onto that list. Absolutely. And it's a tremendous entrustment God has given us. Now, you represented District 26. Mm-hmm. Do you have a biblical, I remember you gave a biblical number for that. Maybe I'm misquoting you. You had the legislature divided, as you just said, and then you had something special for District 26. Maybe it was Psalm 26.
It was Psalm 26.
And why did you... What's
well, because it gives guidance for me to who I should be associating with and relying on and mm-hmm. working with in the legislature to be selective in who I'm working with. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that was clear guidance to me. And so it's interesting, in every desk on the House floor, there's a Bible,
mm-hmm.
okay? In every session, the member who sits in that desk, of course, I sat in the same desk for 6 years, but you write a scripture that means something to you, mm-hmm. and I always wrote Psalm 26.
Yeah.
Right?
So that's just like because most people, when you talk about the intricacies of government, their eyes kind of glaze over, but that's just a neat little nomenclature that you developed concerning right. how to, as J. Vernon McGee used to say, put the cookies on the bottom shelf.
That's right.
Because you can't influence something you don't understand.
That's right.
And I remember when...